This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do. Today's guest is going to be talking to us about a little-known story that had a huge impact on a young man many years ago. I am very pleased to introduce to you today's guest, Jim Akhmoudi. Jim, how are you?
I'm very, very good. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. Now, Jim, we're not going to be talking about you. We're going to be talking about someone you wrote about. In the book, which is entitled The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. Tell us a little bit, give us a little bit of background about the Greg Whitcamper upon which the Class of 65 is based.
Greg was a young man who grew up at a very unusual experimental religious community in South Georgia called Koinonia. It's a Greek word that means fellowship. It was a communal Christian farm. It's actually, I'm putting it in past tense, but it's still there. It's near Americus, Georgia, where Jimmy Carter is from. Plains is just down the road from Americus. It was founded in 1942. And they were very unusual because it was a predominantly white community, the commune, and they believed in three things that made them very unpopular with the locals. They believed in racial equality, they believed in communal living, and they believed in pacifism. And these three things, in the eyes of a lot of locals, made them race mixers and communists and cowards. And they were sort of pariahs in that area. Greg had the misfortune of being the only child from this farm the year that his high school was forced to desegregate in the 1960s, and he was treated horribly.
He was the only child from the farm that held this belief, and therefore was he the only one in the school who was willing to welcome the black students?
He was the only one who publicly did. There were no doubt some of the white students, some of his white classmates, thought it was much ado about nothing and didn't mind having black students there, but Greg was the only one who publicly supported them. In fact, on the second day of classes in his senior year, he rode to school with three of the four black students who were desegregating America's High. He rode with them in the black funeral home limousine that had agreed to bring them to school. And they were met by a mob of white people throwing rocks and bottles and screaming all sorts of ugly things, very much like Little Rock, that sort of scene. Mm-hmm. And when the funeral home limousine pulled up in front of the school and the sheriff scowled at them and opened the door, everybody was very surprised to see that the first person who popped out of the car was this white boy. And he had already been very unpopular in his high school. But from that point forward, he was just a marked man. The black students, don't get me wrong, they were mistreated very much too. Mm-hmm. But Greg, in many ways, was treated even worse because he was considered a traitor to his race.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit more about Greg. I note that there's a quote at the beginning of your book, which is certainly profound. I will share it with the audience. You are quoting Mark Twain, who says, "It is curious that physical courage should be so common in the world, and moral courage so rare." And I think that's an ideal quote for this story about Greg. But again, tell us more about who was this young boy who seemed to be so brave and so steadfast in his beliefs. Tell us about the family in which he grew up, his daily living. What was life like for Greg Whitcamper?
Greg was a preacher's son. His father was a Disciples of Christ minister from Indiana, and his daddy had been kicked out of a number of churches because he was advising young people not to register for the draft. which was a very unpopular thing to be telling young people in the 1940s and right after World War II, when patriotism was probably at its height.
Oh, my.
And he kept getting kicked out of churches, and he heard about this community in Georgia, Koinonia, where people believed in the things he believed in. And he moved his family there in 1953, coincidentally about the same time that Jimmy Carter returned to Sumter County, where America says, after his father died, and he took over the family's peanut business and left the Navy. So they actually came to the county at the same time. Koinonia then was, there were about 60 people living at the farm. It was predominantly white, although there were some black residents, which really, it really irritated a lot of the locals that they had this noontime communal meal where they would sit down with black people.
Because I'm sure,
in deep Georgia, in deep South Georgia in the 1940s and early 1950s, that was not done. But what really got Koinonia into trouble was after the Supreme Court ruled on school desegregation in Brown versus Board in 1954. Not long after that, the founder of Koinonia, a Southern Baptist minister named Clarence Jordan, went to Atlanta and endorsed a couple of black students who wanted to enter the Georgia State College of Business, which is now Georgia State University. And by the time he got back to Americus, it was on the front page of the local paper that the local white minister wanted to desegregate the university system. And overnight, people started attacking Koinonia. There were drive-by shootings. There were their farm market out on U.S. 19 was bombed twice. Their trees were cut down. There was sugar in the gas tanks. Greg and some of his friends, you know, like third and fourth graders, were out playing volleyball one night, and the Klan came by and shot at them. There were several years of violence there. So who was Greg? Greg was a person from a very early age who knew what it's like to be persecuted for his interpretation of Christianity. The people living at this farm were being boycotted, shot at, and bombed because they believed that Christianity called on them to be brothers with everyone.
I wonder if Greg, and I know you've had many conversations with Greg, I wonder if there was ever a moment or two as he was growing up when he gave thought to the idea of really kind of letting go the communal view of what the world should be like. His life would have been a whole lot easier in those times if he had just gone along with the masses.
Well, there was a time. Greg was a strong kid. He did a lot of work on the farm, and he was chiseled. And everybody thought that he probably, the people who were bothering him in school, he probably could have whipped their tails easily. And there was one time during his senior year of high school where Greg was in the school cafeteria, and some of the classmates who had been tormenting him invited him to come over and sit at their table. And Greg was so starved for any sort of attention, you know, he thought maybe they just wanted to debate with him about racial issues or something. He went over there and sat with him, and of course the minute he sat down, somebody threw a sloppy Joe at him. He actually ducked, and it hit another guy, and the guy it hit was so mad that he threw it at Greg and hit him in the shirt. So, long story short, Greg comes home to the farm that afternoon, and he's got this sloppy Joe stain on his shirt. And Clarence Jordan, the founder of the commune, sees him across the field and thinks he's been shot, or that he thinks it's blood.
Oh my!
And he comes up to him, and then when he sees that it's probably it's kind of orange, it's something food related, he just gives him a big hug. And Clarence told him a couple of days later, Greg, I've been thinking about this, and I think maybe this nonviolence thing is really more for adults. I'm thinking that maybe if you just hauled off and cold cocked one of these guys, all this harassment would stop. And Greg seriously considered it. And he told Clarence after he'd thought about it for a few days that he wasn't going to do it. Because he really did believe in nonviolence, and he believed that the best way to handle this situation was not to fight back. there was also a practical side to this. Almost every time Greg was being confronted by his classmates, it was a whole group of people. So if he had fought back against one of them, he would have found himself fighting back against 20 of them, and he wouldn't have won that fight.
Right. Such an extraordinary young man to be wanting to withstand this kind of pressure, and to have to being so solid about his own personal beliefs, not only in racial equality, if you will, but I would suspect pretty much everything that was on his emotional plate of beliefs.
Well, he had had a lot of training. You know, there was a lot of stuff going on in Southwest Georgia back in those days. The civil rights movement came to Southwest Georgia when Greg was about to start high school. The Albany movement started in the fall of 61 when he was entering the high school. And the Albany movement, it's not as well remembered as some of the more famous confrontations in civil rights history, but it's a very notable thing. It was a war of attrition that went on for over a year. It was the first mass protests against segregation in the Deep South in 61 and 62. And there were hundreds and hundreds of people arrested. And Greg and the other people from Koinonia were going down to Albany, which is only about 30 or 35 miles down the road from Americus. And they were going to these mass meetings, and they were hearing Martin Luther King talk, and they were hearing these choirs. And then later, when the movement moved up the road to Americus, they were hearing, they were going to the mass meetings there. They were fully invested in the civil rights movement and in this whole idea of bringing about change through nonviolent resistance. They were getting it from the source, and they believed in it. So it was a profound thing for them. It wasn't just something they were doing because their parents told them to. They actually believed it.
Now, you said that Greg was the only school-age child from Koinonia that went to the school. Who were his friends? Did he have any friends?
Well, let me back up a minute. There were other children from Koinonia who went to this high school and were mistreated, but they were all older than Greg.
I see.
They actually, in the fall of 1960, three of the Koinonia children, their parents actually had to go to federal court to get them admitted into the school, because the school was saying, we don't want you to come here because there will be dissension and violence and unrest if you do. And actually, they were kind of right. And they had to get a federal court order forcing them into the school because, you know, the judge recognized religious persecution when he saw it. And so Greg's older brother was one of those first three students. And from the beginning, when these Koinonia kids went into the high school in the fall of 1960, they were harassed. At that point, America's High was an all-white high school. There weren't any black students. And Greg came along later. He was, and just through happenstance, in his senior year, 64-65, he was the only Koinonia kid there.
I see.
In the very year when they had to desegregate, so all of the anger over that fell on him. But you asked about who his friends were. His friends were black. Greg knew a lot of black students from his activities in the civil rights movement. He had marched with some of them. He had been to the mass meetings. He socialized with them. They were his friends. If it hadn't been for the black students who were his friends, he probably would have gone crazy during his high school years, because none of the white students would give him the time of day other than to spit on him and call him names.
Literally to spit on him and call him names.
Literally. Oh, literally, yes.
So here's this young kid, and you've got pictures of him throughout the book. He's a nice-looking kid. Could have had a very, very different life, but for his beliefs, which were so strongly held by himself as well as by his family. It's interesting that the Koinonia family had to go to court for permission for the white children to be able to go to that school. I'm not sure that's a story that many people are aware of during that time.
Well, you know, when we hear about standard histories of the civil rights movement, the emphasis is always totally correctly on what black people did to get their rights. It was a black movement, but it was a black movement that would not have succeeded without allies among whites. And King understood that very well. I mean, that's what the letter from the Birmingham jail is all about. The letter from the Birmingham jail, you know, which he wrote when he was being held in Birmingham in the spring of 1963, is basically a plea to white clergymen in the South saying, you think I'm rabble-rousing. You're wondering why I'm pushing this so fast. I want you all to think about what the Bible says. You know better than this. We're all Christians. You know better than this. It was his appeal to their conscience. And obviously, a lot of those people, the appeal didn't work, but it worked on a lot of them. There were always white allies for the civil rights movement, and Koinonia in the 1950s, that this community in Southwest Georgia were some of the most conspicuous allies. Clarence Jordan was had spoken at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, King's Church in Montgomery, when it was under an earlier pastor. And then when the Montgomery bus boycott happened in 55 and 56, Jordan wrote very supportive letters to King and spoke out on their behalf. And then later that year, in 56, when Koinonia started getting terrorized and the violence came against them and the shootings and the bombings, King wrote a beautiful letter to Jordan about how we've been there. We know what you're going through. We're all in this together.
So very supportive.
And actually, Jordan ended up speaking at Dexter Avenue about a year later. He went over there and spoke one Sunday at King's invitation. So they were, Koinonia actually got a lot of publicity during all this violence in the 50s, and it was around the same time as all of the bombings and things that were going on because of the bus boycott in Montgomery, and it was all for the same reasons, just happening to people of different complexions.
I wonder what Greg's thought was. What was his understanding of the people who were so opposed to integration? Did he just chalk it up to ignorance or fear, or did he ever talk to you about that, how he understood what they were dealing with?
Oh, absolutely. Greg thinks that he's no better than them, and he didn't even think that then. He thought that it was all an accident of birth. He thought that his parents believed a certain way, and his classmates who were segregationists, their parents believed a certain way, and they had been raised differently than him, and he thinks, his phrase he always uses is, if our cradles had been switched at birth, I'd be one of them hectoring me, and they could just as easily be me. It was all an accident of how, of who raised them and what belief system he came up in.
Okay. So it's interesting because even in that, there sounds like there was an acceptance that these people who looked like him but certainly didn't treat him well by any stretch, that the only difference was the way that they were brought up. It wasn't that he saw them as particularly bad or evil people. He just saw them as people who had different beliefs from his. And it sounds like he did not necessarily blame them for their beliefs, although he certainly didn't celebrate their beliefs.
That's generally true. Now, to be honest, there were some real rough cases who were, you know, I hate this term, but they were kind of rednecks, or in many cases they were members of the football team. The football team, a lot of the football players thought of themselves as defenders of the social order. They were the enforcers. And some of those people, the people who were tripping Greg on the steps and spitting on him and all that, no, Greg didn't have good feelings about them. But he always felt that they were the minority. He always felt that maybe 25% of his classmates were actively against him. He felt that most of the classmates were either indifferent or they didn't really like what was going on, but they were too scared to say anything or didn't know what they should say. So he sort of, they weren't faceless to him. He sort of made distinctions between the people who were the hard cases and the people who were just going around along with the crowd, and who probably, when I'm saying that the accident, the switched at the cradle, switched at birth thing, it really applies more to the people that who were kind of going along with the crowd.
I
Some
see.
Of the people were hard cases, and he didn't, you know, he didn't have much love lost for them.
Well, that's kind of understandable.
I think so.
You talk about the football team as sort of seeing themselves as the defender of the social order. Were they members of the Klan, the football team?
Some of their parents were. There was probably the most dramatic day of Greg's senior year was because of a football player. In fact, I devoted a whole chapter of the book to this because it's such a significant encounter. In the fall of Greg's senior year, there was one football player who accused Greg of tripping him in class and of calling him a bad name. And he said, "I'm going to see you after class." And Greg just kind of laughed it off and didn't think anything of it. And then he started hearing all these rumors sweeping through the school that this guy was going to, you know, whip his tail after class. And when he was leaving school that afternoon, he was walking by the baseball field, and a group of probably about four dozen boys stepped out from behind the baseball grandstand. And this guy who said he was going to meet him after school came up to him and said, "We're going to have it out here right now. We're going to fight."
Four dozen boys.
Yeah, yeah.
Jim?
Most of the boys in that senior class. The senior class was only about 110 students.
It's hard to imagine that four dozen would go after the one. Jim, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to pick up right here because I want to hear about what happened between Jim and these four dozen boys. Folks, I am talking with author Jim Akhmoudi, who is author of The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. And as horrifying as these examples seem, yes, there was a road to forgiveness. So don't go away. We'll be right back. These four dozen boys who came out to have a fight, it sounds like, with Greg, what happened?
Well, Greg, the boy who felt like Greg had tripped him and called him a bad name, confronted Greg, and a whole bunch of people surrounded him, and Greg was telling him he wasn't going to fight him, and somebody came up from behind Greg and ripped the books out of his hand, and they fell to the ground. And as Greg was looking around to see who it was who did that, the guy who had said that he was going to fight him hauled off and hit him with his fist full force right in his cheek. And Greg stumbled. He almost fell. I mean, it was a really hard blow, and then this is almost biblical. He, instead of trying to run away or say something else or whatever, he walked right up to this guy, a guy named Thomas. He jutted out his chin as if to take another blow, and he said, "Thomas, I love you." And Thomas, His arms just dropped at the side of his body. He didn't know what to do. And at that moment, a couple of adults, a coach, and I think an off-duty police officer who had been watching from the periphery, came in and broke it up.
That's an extraordinary scene.
One of the people who was watching that scene was one of Greg's classmates, a fellow named Joseph Logan, who was the co-captain of the football team that year. And Joseph, at the time, thought it was just he wanted to see somebody kick Greg's butt. And he couldn't stand Greg and everything that he stood for. But many years later, Joseph, he became a college professor in Alabama. Many years later, Joseph was teaching Sunday school in the Methodist church he belonged to, and he used that scene and Greg's response to getting hit like that in a sermon.
Interesting. It's almost chilling to think about the courage that and the belief that it took in the body of Greg to make that statement and to say it so powerfully that it absolutely changed the dynamic of what could have happened, could have gone very wrong that day. They could have killed him.
Well, he could have been hurt very badly, and it isn't like he hadn't thought about fighting back. I mean, one of Greg's best friends during this period was a young black man who was working at Koinonia as a farm at the farm as an employee, and who was actually a civil rights activist. He was a SNCC activist, an organizer in Americus, a guy named Collins McGee. Collins was a Golden Glove boxer, and Collins had been given Greg boxing lessons.
Interesting.
Because he said, I know you don't believe in this nonviolence, but you might find yourself in a situation one day where you need to take a swing back. And Greg at least thought about it seriously enough to where he took some lessons from Collins. But when it came right down to it, he didn't swing back.
Interesting. You write about the concern that Greg had on the day that the principal made the announcement about the black students coming to school. And Greg was really disappointed in the way the principal made the announcement. Describe that moment, if you would.
Well, they had a special assembly of all the white students to tell them that the school board had decided to allow a very limited number of black students to attend classes there. There were four students who were going to be coming. And instead of saying something neutral, or even trying to say something eloquent about how the world's changing and we have to get with the program, the principal basically said, you know, none of us likes this, and, you know, just don't let the place blow up. I mean, his attitude was sort of like, you don't have to be their friends, but don't do anything that's going to get us in the newspaper. And Greg thought that was awful. Greg thought that this guy really missed an opportunity to try to make a life lesson out of it. And it was one of the things that motivated him to volunteer to ride to class with the black students to show his support for them.
Interesting. The principal certainly made his views clear, in as much as in what he said as in what he didn't say. What kind of interaction was there between Greg's parents and the principal? Anything?
Oh, there wasn't anything. Koinonia was such an outcast place in Americus that anything that these parents could have said to the principal just wouldn't have gone very far. The fact that you were from Koinonia and saying it to them, you might as well have been, you know, a member of the Communist Party coming in and saying something. So Koinonia was so discredited in the town that, because, I mean, this had been going on for years. They had been outcast by the town going back for a decade before Greg's senior year. So no, there wasn't much they could say about it. And Greg's parents, you know, Koinonia had been persecuted for so long at this point that Greg, his parents' attitude about it was sort of like, you know, we're Christians. You should expect this. You know, they used to feed us to the lions.
Not very comforting for a young boy, but yeah, I get that.
His father, the preacher, was really more that way. His mother was more. I mean, she was more like, tell me what happened, and I'll give you a hug and all that. But there wasn't anything they could do to stop it. And, you know, the Koinonia children, some of the ones like Greg handled it all pretty well, but other ones were really upset by all this and blamed their parents for many years, still blamed their parents, actually, for putting them on the front line of a social battle that they did not choose themselves.
And for those children who were not as Greg, how have they fared over time? How did they fare during that time?
Well, of the Koinonia children who went to America's High School, only one of them stayed through and to graduation, and it was the a daughter of Clarence Jordan, the founder, Jan Jordan. She graduated the year before Greg in the spring of 1964. And she actually caused a stir at her graduation because she had some of her black friends come to the graduation, and they wouldn't let them sit down front with all the other families and friends. They had to sit on the like at the back row of the grandstand, and Jan wouldn't come and get her diploma. She actually took out an ad in the America's Times Recorder newspaper explaining why she had not come up and gotten her diploma. She refused to be part of this thing. She wanted to sit in the back row with her black friends. Most of the other Koinonia children got out of there as soon as they could. Greg's older brother, Billy, who was one of the people who was involved in that lawsuit in 1960, Billy stayed 1 year at America's High School, and then they shipped him off up to Chicago, where he finished his schooling with a religious community up there. Some of the others also left and went out of state to go to school somewhere else. Greg, I think one of the main reasons he decided to stick it out, even though it was so unpleasant and so horrible, was because his older brother hadn't done it. And I think there's a little bit of, you know, sibling rivalry, I'm tougher than you involved in it.
There was a time when Greg went to North Dakota. What was that about?
Well, there was 1 year. He spent his ninth grade year at America's High School. And then in his 10th grade year, the commune was falling apart. It had dwindled down to just a handful of people. The boycott, in particular, against Koinonia for many years. They couldn't sell their farm products anywhere around there. They couldn't buy farm supplies. And they were being squeezed to death, really, almost, this community. And they were looking at ways there was an alternative community up in North Dakota that they were thinking about merging with. And the Whitcamper family went up there during Greg's sophomore year to see whether that marriage would work. They were thinking about giving up on Georgia, in other words. And for various reasons, it didn't work. But Greg got a respite from America's during his sophomore year. And then he came back to America's after that other thing didn't work out in North Dakota. He came back for his junior and senior years.
And was that the time during which, at one point, Greg kind of stopped paying attention to his own daily living requirements? He stopped showering. He was just sort of unto himself in a very...
During his junior year, there was a period there where he was so disgusted with being an outcast and so down on his classmates that he just sort of decided that, well, you know, they don't like me. They think I'm bad. I'm going to act bad. He stopped taking a shower. He was unkempt. He basically had decided that if they think I stink, I'm going to literally stink. And the principal called him in one day and said, you know, you're not going to make any friends by doing this. And Greg said, well, you know, I'm not going to make any friends anyway.
Right.
But he finally relented and decided that wasn't a very smart thing to do. But yeah, he sort of protested. He had a silent protest by not cleaning himself up there for a while.
So clearly, I mean, you know, for all the years that he was there, it was not the most pleasant experience in the world. Ultimately, he graduated. Ultimately, he moved away and lived his life. But then something really interesting happened in August of 2013. What was that?
Well, let me back up just a minute. At the end of his senior year, when he graduated in the June of 1965, it was pretty much like the rest of his senior year had gone. When they called his name to get his diploma, he was booed. He had come with his black friend, Collins, to the ceremony. And he and Collins were walking away from the ceremony, and they were chased by a group of, I don't know, a dozen or two dozen men who were throwing things at him and calling him names and everything. So it began, it ended very much the way it had begun. But another thing that was very important happened at that graduation. One of his white classmates, a guy named David Morgan, who throughout Greg's senior, he had started the senior year kind of laughing at Greg and being part of the crowd that jeered him and laughed when somebody would spit on him or trip him down the stairs. David had increasingly become discomforted by this and began to think that maybe this was really awful. And he had actually said a couple of things in their classes that, you know, maybe we should leave Greg alone and everybody else would, you know, then start bothering David. At their graduation in 1965, David came up to Greg in front of everyone and shook his hand and said, "I don't know how you made it." And Greg says that was by far the nicest thing any white classmate did to him his whole time at the high school.
Interesting.
What happened years later was that David was the person planning their 40th reunion. And David, who had never forgotten about Greg, reached out to a handful of their classmates who he knew had all also been troubled by the way Greg had been treated and said, "Do you ever think about Greg and what we did to him?"
Interesting.
And they came up with this idea of writing apology letters to him. And in the spring of 2006, Greg, who had lived, he moved to West Virginia not long after he finished college and had lived up there for about 40 years. And he goes to the post office box one day and finds an invitation to his class reunion in America's, which he's never gotten before, so that was startling enough. And he finds a letter from his former classmate, David Morgan. Have I got a minute just to read the beginning of that
Absolutely.
Letter? It says, "Dear Greg, I expect you will be quite surprised to hear from me. If you remember me at all, it will likely be for unpleasant reasons. I was a classmate of yours at America's High School and graduated with you in 1965. I don't recall ever directly assaulting you, but I probably did to gain the acceptance and accolades of my peers. In any case, I surely participated as part of an enabling audience and tacitly supported and encouraged those who did. For that, I am deeply sorry and regretful. Throughout the last 40-plus years, I have occasionally thought of you in those dark days that you endured at our hands. As I matured, I became more and more ashamed and wished that I had taken a different stand back then." The letter goes on for quite a while. It's a very beautiful letter. And the most remarkable part of it was David's wasn't the only letter. In the next day's mail, Greg had several more letters from classmates who were apologizing to him and asking him to come back to their 40th reunion. He received about a dozen letters like that.
Interesting, a dozen.
In the space of a few days. And they moved him to tears. And some of his friends, some of the people who had grown up with him at Koinonia, didn't trust it. They thought Greg should not go back to Georgia because they thought that these people had not changed, and if he went back, it was just going to be a trap. One of Greg's, one of the women who grew up with him at Koinonia, who lived not far from him in West Virginia, said, "If you go back to Georgia, you better take your guns."
Well, you know, based on what Greg experienced while he was there, it was a very reasonable fear. And at this point, Greg was married, yes?
Yes, Greg was married and had a it was his second marriage, and he was he had a couple of children by his first wife, but he had a young daughter, Sally Ann, at this point, and he really hadn't talked very much about what he went through in high school with his second wife and with his daughter. And when he did talk about it, he would often cry. As a matter of fact, Greg still cries about it. He has talked about it a fair amount in recent years, especially to me. But if you start asking about something that happened to him in senior year, like that day at the baseball grandstand when he was hit and all that, it just doesn't take very long for all of that emotion to come flooding back up through his eyes.
Not surprising at all. I wonder, what did he go through that allowed him to actually go back? And his wife, I'm sure, had to have been very concerned about what he would potentially face.
Well, Greg called David Morgan and all of the other people who had written him letters and talked to them at length, and he was convinced of their sincerity. He did not think that they were putting it on. He didn't see any reason why they would be putting it on. And he thought he should go back. He thought it would be healing for everyone. Greg, people often ask me, how was Greg able to handle all this so philosophically? And a lot of it has to do with the fact that he got out of South Georgia very soon after high school. He went to college in early 1966, and it was a very unusual college experience. He was part of an experimental Quaker college program called Friends World College.
Yes.
And the idea was that they would send you around the world to immerse yourself in different cultures. And in Greg's case, he studied world religions. And he was out of the country for about 3 years in the late 60s, backpacking through Europe, going to spending time in a Buddhist monastery in Japan. He was in Africa. He was in the Middle East. He was in India. He got as far away from Georgia as he could. And it was very, very good for him to have this mind-broadening experience so soon after all the traumas he had gone through in high school.
I would think so.
And he had nightmares a couple of times.
Well, I'm not surprised.
When he was in Africa, he had nightmares a couple of times where he was back in America's high school and he had a submachine gun in his hand and was killing all his classmates.
That's quite a nightmare. That would be enough to make many people very concerned.
Well, he was as relieved that it was handled in his subconscious and not handled by his hands. You know?
I can say, as are we all who are hearing about his story and all that he had to endure. We're going to take a break, Jim, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about Greg's actual return to Koinonia and what that was like for Greg and for his family and for the people who had caused him so much harm. Folks, this is Pamela Brewerick. We will be right back to continue the conversation with Jim Ockmoody, who is the author of The Class of 65. We will learn more about Greg Whitcamp and the long road to forgiveness. Don't go away. To the day that Greg walked into his old high school for the first time in 48 years.
Well, when he went back for the reunion, which was in June of 2006, they did a smart thing. Before the reunion itself, they got together. Some of the people who had written Greg letters got together for lunch with him at the house of an English teacher, Gladys Crabb, who had always been very sympathetic to Greg in high school, who kind of understood what he was going through, and who in her own way had sort of helped broker this reconciliation. They had lunch at her house, and it was very emotional. There were a lot of tears. There were several of the women there had actually not known some of the things that Greg had gone through in high school. And that's not surprising because it was mostly the boys who were doing it.
Okay.
And they weren't really bragging to their girlfriends about, oh, you know, today I spit on Greg. They weren't telling them these things. So they were actually finding out about a lot of it. I mean, they knew Greg was unpopular and that he was being hectored to a certain extent, but they didn't know the full extent of it.
Okay.
And one of the most emotional moments in that luncheon was when Greg told them about the dream he had had where he was shooting them all down. They just all kind of glared at him like, I mean, they didn't know what to say. It was just sort of like, well, we're glad there isn't any lasting damage, but boy, this is serious stuff.
Wow. And maybe they got another side of a glimpse into how hurt and enraged he was with how badly he was being treated and for so long.
Mm-hmm. And the reunion itself was not held at the high school. It was held at the old Carnegie Library in Americus. And in some ways, the reunion wasn't nearly as emotional as this luncheon with the other people. There were some people at the reunion who clearly didn't like the idea of this reconciliation being so front and center and such a significant part of their 40th reunion. But here's the thing that had changed. In 1965, the people who weren't crazy about it would have been the people who would have been leading things and saying things. In 2006, they were coming up and shaking Greg's hand and then walking away quietly. They weren't saying things because by then it had become, you didn't say things about that kind of stuff if you didn't want to be marginalized. They were the ones who were marginalized.
It's interesting, though, how long and how fully people can hold on to beliefs such as theirs, based purely on the color of skin.
Well, I focused an awful lot of this book on the people who wrote the letters to Greg and how they changed, because when I think about it, these people were segregation. Jim Crow was legal until they were beginning their senior year. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was during the break between their junior and senior year. So they were, they were well into adolescence before everything changed. And they had a lot of stuff to process. They were children of segregation in every way that you can think about it. And so I spend a lot of the book, particularly the second half of the book, sort of tracing how these people's attitudes evolved over the years. How could somebody who despised what Greg stood for and didn't want those black students in their high school, how could somebody who felt that way in 1965 write such a beautiful letter to Greg asking for his forgiveness 40 years later? And I was proud of that aspect of the book, because it's one thing just to write about the ugly things that happened half a century ago and more.
Yes.
But I think what I really wanted to also capture was the way people can change and our capacity for evolution and reconciliation.
The four black students, were they invited to the reunion?
No, and that's the epilogue of my book deals with that a great deal. Number one, none of them would have probably been invited because none of them were members of the class of 65. The four black students who all came to that school were underclass.
I see.
They were two sophomores and two juniors.
Mm-hmm.
So you can understand why none of them would have been invited to this reunion. But the larger question is, have they been extended these same apologies and offers of reconciliation that Greg has? And sadly, the answer is, for the most part, no. There have been a couple of instances. There's one anecdote that plays a large part in the epilogue where one of the black students in the school, Robertina Freeman, she's a book in herself, she's the only one of the first four who stuck it out and graduated there. She's a remarkable woman. She, many years later, her sister became principal of America's High School and invited her to come back and speak. She didn't want to do it, Robertina, but she did as a favor to her sister. And when she was there, one of the teachers there, a white teacher, stood up in front of this assembly and said, you know, I was one of those people who was harassing you back then, and I am so sorry, and we were wrong, you were right, and I just want to welcome you back to your alma mater.
Well, it's interesting how things really can change, that Robertina's sister was the principal of a school, and I think, of course, of the principal who Greg was exposed to, who could never have imagined such a thing would happen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think you can probably predict what happened there. After Greg's senior year, a lot more black students came. There was a lot more unrest. There was a white segregation academy founded down there called Southland Academy. Over the years, more and more of the white students started going to the private school. And when Greg and I walked back into that school in 2013, it was, America's High was about 90% black. And, you know, and that's happened all over America. It's not just America's. It's not just...
Yeah.
It's not just the places that have the old segregation academies from the 60s. It's happened, and you know, I grew up in Atlanta, and it pretty much the same thing happened in the high school I grew up in suburban Atlanta. The words were different. Some of the feelings may not have been as raw, but the end result was the same.
What was it like for Greg to actually walk into the school and see certainly the racial change after so many years? Did he comment to you on that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we went to a banquet. Greg and I went down there and attended a reunion of the Sumter County movement, the civil rights movement in America's. And their banquet on Saturday night was held in the gymnasium where he had been booed when he got his diploma. It was still there. Jimmy Carter, the Carters were there. And Greg was, it was strange. That evening was very emotional because we were hearing from all these heroes of the movement. And but at the same time, Greg was walking around saying, well, here's where they threw a rock at me, and here's where they called me a name, and here's where I went up and got my diploma and got booed. And so it was just a lot of layers of ironic meaning and memory.
Indeed, different heroes of the same movement.
Yeah, I mean, Koinonia, the people with the civil rights movement down there consider Koinonia one of their great allies and fully recognize them. And it's an unusual situation because not all that many communities in the Deep South that went through really serious civil rights confrontations had a white entity so close there that was all for them.
Yeah.
In most cases, they didn't.
Right, right. What's Greg's life like today as we speak?
Greg, well, it's funny. There's a whole group of Koinonia children who moved up to West Virginia in the 70s. There's a group of about six of them who live within a few miles of each other in the southern Allegheny Mountains near the Greenbrier Resort in that area. They all moved up there sort of in the spirit of latter-day hippiedom and Mother Earth news. And you know, Greg, he used his hands. I mean, he knew how to do a bunch of stuff from growing up as a farm kid, so he knew how to build barns and dig wells and do all that, and he sort of did that kind of work up there for a while. And he was fortunate. He ended up buying a lot of land up there when it was really dirt cheap, and he has essentially made his living as a real estate guy. He sells property to people who want vacation homes because all that land he bought so cheaply in the 70s and 80s is worth a lot more now, because this is a beautiful part of West Virginia that was not mined for coal. And some of his land has natural gas in it.
Oh my.
I always joke with him. I tell him that he's getting paid back for all the bad things that happened to him as a teenager.
What was it like for you going back in time with Greg and meeting these folks and learning about what he experienced?
Well, I had always known a lot about Koinonia. I was a reporter at the Journal-Constitution in Atlanta for almost 30 years. And one of the first, literally the first out-of-town assignment I ever did was to go down to Koinonia in the fall of 1980 and write a feature story on how they were faring. I had heard about them and about all of the their history of persecution. And then a few years after that, there was another reason to know a lot about Koinonia. We haven't even mentioned this, but Koinonia is also the birthplace of Habitat for Humanity.
Right, right.
Habitat was grew out of a housing ministry that started there about the time Greg was graduating. Millard and Linda Fuller came to Koinonia a few months after Greg graduated from high school, and Millard became really a soulmate with the founder, Clarence Jordan, and they dreamed up the idea that evolved into Habitat. So I went to Americus a lot of times over the years to write stories about the Carters and about Koinonia and Habitat, and also the Andersonville POW, Civil War POW camp is on the northern end of the county, so there's a really fat slab of history in that county. And I went there a lot of times over the years, so I knew bits and pieces of the story. I didn't know what happened to the children. That was the part that was new. I didn't know what had happened to the children, and I certainly didn't know about Greg and the reunion, and that was all new to me. I just felt like it was a story I was meant to tell.
Well, you certainly have told it very well. We are today living in some really challenging times. What's your view of the state of the world in which we live today?
Well, one of the first talks I made when the book came out was at the Albany Civil Rights Museum, and people there, and this was actually a little bit, this was like about 2 weeks before the shootings in Charleston, but there had been so many things in the news about police incidents and all that people basically wanted to know whether I thought we had made a lot of progress since 1965. Number one, I think you'd have to be foolish to say that we aren't a lot better off than we were in 1965. In 1965, we were only recently coming out of Jim Crow, and a lot of black people in the South couldn't even vote. But there's a lot of disappointment that it hasn't been a steady progress since then. I think anything like this, where the attitudes are so long-standing and so ingrained, it's difficult to change minds. So many minds have changed. So many hearts have changed. So many laws and other things have changed. But there's always setbacks. To me, the last 50 years is a process of two steps forward, one step back. And you just have to keep remembering that that's still net one step forward. Can't lose sight of that and keep working for it. Nothing, just because a lot of really incredible people stood up for their rights 50 years ago and did some wonderful things and some very brave and heroic things doesn't mean it's settled for all time. We all have to keep pushing.
For folks who are hearing our conversation today, what do you want them to get from the class of 65?
I want them to understand that you can always make amends, that you can, you know, if you did something earlier in your life that was wrong, that there is a lot of value to tracking down someone and apologizing. But it's even better not to have to apologize in the first place.
Indeed. And you have hope for the future.
Of course I do. Of course I do. I think we're a much more just society now than we were 50 years ago when Greg was a senior. And more importantly, we should all resolve to work that continues, that we keep taking two steps forward.
Jim, how can folks follow the work that you do, the writing that you do?
I've got a website, jimockmoody.com, where I keep everybody up to date with all that stuff.
Well, I'm going to have to ask you to spell the name for the website.
Okay, it's Jim.
The Jim part we got.
Jim is easy. And the last name is A-U-C-H. M as in mother, U-T-E-Y. So jimockmoody.com. Ockmoody is one of those weird Scottish names.
Well, we will allow you to have it nevertheless. Jim, thank you for spending the time with us today. Thank you for this book. It is beautifully written. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Pamela. This has been fun.
All righty. And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And you remember, if it's unacceptable, then it is clearly unacceptable. Take care. We'll be right back.